Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
As farmers get ready to close the books on 2023, analysts at the USDA are forecasting that this year farmers as a whole will record quite a cut in net cash income, a drop of 21% from last year's record high. But USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer says we need to put the 2023 projected net cash income figure of just under $158 billion in perspective.
Despite what is a large percentage decrease on the order of 20% in net cash farm income year over year, where we're sitting at for 2023 is still exceeds the 20-year average by quite a bit.
He says another way to look at it, if you take together net incomes from 21, 2022, and 23.
This is the three highest consecutive years in the last 50 years.
A condition Meyer says is simply
exceptional.
Exceptional. Gary Crawford, Washington.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, I actually had the opportunity to meet with Ranking Member Bozeman from the Senate Ag Committee today, and yet, the chances of us having the 23 Farm Bill are gone. There's only about 8 legislative days left in this year.
Chandler Gould is CEO of the National Association of Wheat Growers in Washington, D.C., confirming no new Farm Bill in 2023. But what's ahead?
And we've already got a one-year extension that has moved the Farm Bill expiration to September 30th of 2024. I think the most important thing is for us to push to have a Farm Bill done as soon as we can in the next year. I would prefer it to be in the first quarter. I'm worried about us losing additional funding to write a Farm Bill if the bill is moved later into next year. Senator Bozeman was very clear that it is a top priority for him to get a farm bill done as soon as possible. I also know it's a top priority for both the chair and the ranking members of the Senate and House Agriculture Committee. And so we need to continue to talk about that need to get the farm bill done and to bring additional resources in so that we can make sure the risk management tools and the safety net are actually true risk management tools and a safety net reflective of today's current cost of production.
Now, many in agriculture will point to crop insurance as being a key component of an effective safety net. But just last week, Government Accountability Office, or GAO, releasing a report on crop insurance.
You know, the GAO report falls short on some of its reasoning. Basically, they wanted to apply means testing in order to qualify for different crop insurance programs. But what the GA report didn't explain is how much it actually costs the farm. So just because you may have a farmer that's got, you know, $1 million, $5 million, $8 million into their operation does not mean they're bringing millions of dollars home. I mean, that by the time you do seed and fertilizer and run your tractors and pay staff that you have, there is an extremely high investment into getting a crop in. There's a very high investment of getting a crop out. And you just hope somewhere in the middle, there is a margin that lets you put a little bit of money in your bank account so that you can feed your family and pay your mortgage. And so this is an issue that comes from the far left and from the far right. But you see that the American Enterprise Institute and many of these extremely conservative think tanks are really who weighed in and who have been promoting this particular GAO report. It's unfortunate that the GAO came out and supported the means testing, but this is not the first time that we've had to defend the importance of risk management tools for all farmers and all wheat growers, regardless of their size.
But already that report is picking up steam. As Oregon's Earl Blumenauer sat in front of the House Ag Committee on Member Day earlier in the week, calling for major reforms.
Here's what it comes down to. Every farmer, every farm pays a premium. I mean, crop insurance isn't free. I mean, they have their own skin in the game. But if you start disqualifying growers because of the size of their farm or the equity value that is going into the crop itself, then you're going to make crop insurance actuarially unsound. If you start disqualifying people, and when you start disqualifying larger farmers, then you're going to bankrupt the program so that small and medium farmers will not be able to participate in it because they'll have to raise premiums so high that they can't afford it. So having large farmers in the program actually benefits the small and medium farmer to help kick premiums within reach of their operation.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Now that the CFPB's rule has been finalized after all of these years, so many other small businesses in Iowa, North Carolina, in Texas, in California, and all across the country will be able to reap the benefits of a more transparent lending marketplace that Ms. Young should have had.
California Representative Maxine Waters is ranking member of the House Committee on Small Business.
Specifically, the CFPB rule will allow small businesses to comparison shop between lenders and see much other small businesses, how much other small businesses are being charged for their loans. This price transparency is essential to a competitive and fair marketplace. In designing the rule, the CFPB was mindful of its impact on community financial institutions. For example, the rule completely exempts lenders that originate fewer than 100 small business loans in each of the two preceding years. This fully exempts more than 80% of depository institutions, including 98% of credit unions. For lenders that originate more than 100 loans, they would have more than 2 years before they would need to begin to comply with the rule in 2026. Make no mistake, Senate Joint Resolution 32 is just another part of Republicans' relentless attack on the CFPB. They have erroneously claimed that the CFPB is unconstitutional and unaccountable, and have even gone so far as to attempt to eliminate the agency altogether.
Representative Rashida Tlaib is from Michigan.
The resolution that they're attempting to use to overturn this rule is about small business lending. We know that. But I'm like, what? What's the problem? We're now afraid of data? We don't want to collect data? And it's even voluntary. They can say it's not. It is voluntary. You're opposing a process that would help create more transparency, more information gathering, competitiveness, fair marketplace for lenders and small businesses. It's voluntary. We're scared now? We're scared of voluntarily collecting data? Section 1071 note we all know allows lenders to collect and report lending data, including voluntarily self-reported by businesses, business owners. This rule does help small businesses. And I'm going to give you some examples, particularly those owned by women, people of color. We're even going to collect data, especially in my district, of veterans, many of them black men and women who have started businesses after they served our country. They all are lacking access to credit that they need to build up their businesses. Study after study have documented that small business owners, especially the small business owners in my district, continue to face discriminatory practices by banks. We already know for a fact that black-owned businesses are less likely to obtain financing and offer small loans. Section 1071 will make it easier to eliminate such practices and enforce our fair lending laws. Again, to enforce our fair lending laws. Maybe that's why. Maybe that's why the banks are crying about this voluntary process. They're scared. Why? Had the CFPB small business lending rule been in place during the Paycheck Protection Program, Madam Chair, the transparency requirement required by this rule would likely have reduced the racial disparity in lending outcomes that we saw.
Opponents point to the 900-plus pages for the rule and the 81 questions small lenders have to ask. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Soybean producers may be considering testing for soybean cyst nematodes this fall. K-State crop row plant pathology specialist Rodrigo Onofre discusses why producers should consider testing now and what problems soybean cyst nematodes can cause.
Soybean cyst nematode, it's a major problem for us across the soybean region production. So right now, it's the best time to think about it because we're planning for the 2024 season. We can see lower yields depending on the population. And typically, we don't see a visual symptom when we're out there during the season. Sometimes you see a little bit of stunted plants, yellowish discoloration. It's a really hard to diagnose in season, right? Sampling is essential for a good management.
Onofre says where the most soybean cyst nematodes are in Kansas and how that has changed from previous years.
What we found is SCN is present in about 62 counties here in Kansas, and those 62 counties are responsible for about 85% of the total soybean that is produced here by our growers. And what we have seen is a shift from the eastern part of the state to the central part of the state. So the hot spots right now, not that they're not in the eastern part of the state, where we're starting to find more and more high levels of SCN on that central, south-central part of the state.
He explains how to properly collect samples, label them, and who can help with the process of sending soil samples for soybean cyst nematode testing.
It's a very typical soil fertility test, if you think about that way. You're going to need your soil probe, a bucket, and a labeled bag, which it should include as much information as possible, such as field identification in case we have to apply any management for that specific field, the size of the area that's being sampled, as well as crop rotation, just to let us know a little bit more about the history on that field. It would be good to have that Z pattern where you're collecting multiple samples, and we say about 10 to 20 samples per field that's being sampled. And that field, typically, if I had to pick a number, would it be about 20 acres. I know sometimes my field might represent more than that, but just for the sampling purpose, if you're really trying to pin down where SCN is present in your field, 20 acres is always a good number to start with. It's always good to work with your K-State Extension agents. They will help you either to sample or to help send those samples to the K-State Plant Diagnostic Lab here at K-State.
That was Kansas State University row crop plant pathology specialist Rodrigo Onofre with how many acres producers can include in the sampling. Testing for soybean cyst nematodes this time of year should allow producers time to prepare for next year if it is in their field. I'm Allie Nippert.
Thanks, Allie. And when it comes to soybeans, what about growing biofuel demand? Alexa Kambelik is Director of Government Affairs with the American Soybean Association.
The higher blends infrastructure incentive program, which is housed over at the USDA, and that program provides grants to different entities that are looking to distribute biofuels in a way to get them to consumers faster. Here in the DMV area, the DC, Maryland, Virginia area, the farmers out here who are growing soybeans would love to be using biodiesel as much as their counterparts in the Midwest on their farms to sort of have that full circle sustainability story of soybeans. And it's really difficult to get it out here. Depending on where you are, it might be, you know, nearly impossible for someone to find biodiesel available for sale, you know, within a 20-mile radius of them. So programs like this help get that infrastructure out here. And every time grants are released, they are eaten up right away. There is not a dollar left. And so we know this program is working. We know that it's highly desirable, and we're looking forward to seeing that continue.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
As chairman of the Congressional Western Caucus, a member of the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Agriculture, and maybe more importantly, as a third-generation farmer representing Central Washington, it's certainly a privilege to work with members of this distinguished committee.
Representative Dan Newhouse in front of the House Ag Committee for Member Day.
As we continue to address rural policy issues and support our farmers, our ranchers, and the agricultural industry, I appreciate the opportunity to testify today and want to highlight several important provisions as you develop the next Farm Bill. The Farm Bill, as you know, impacts all Americans, and this legislation must be carefully crafted to promote American agriculture, preserve our premier research institutions, improve forest health to prevent catastrophic wildfires, and provide a safety net to ensure the long-term success of America's agricultural industry. Trade continues to be critical for American farmers and ranchers, and our agricultural products are a key part of the global food supply. The Farm Bill must ensure that agricultural exports are prioritized in market promotion and that U.S. food aid continues to support American producers. It should reauthorize and consider expanding the Market Access Program, which is the main export promotion program that helps producers increase American agricultural product exports. Additionally, the Foreign Market Development Program, the Emerging Markets Program, and the Technical Assistance for Specialty Crops all play an important role in establishing new international markets for our products in foreign countries. My bill, the Agriculture Export Promotion Act of 2023, would expand and extend MAP and FMD programs to ensure that American farmers and ranchers have the support they need to grow their businesses. My district is home to a significant number of organic growers, and I'm concerned by the lack of urgency and collaboration from USDA in updating organic standards. Consumer trust in organics relies on strong and consistently updated voluntary standards that reflect the latest facts on environmental and ecological data, consumer demands, and innovative best practices. To address this issue, I, along with others on this committee, with overwhelming support from our growers across the country, introduced the Continuous Improvement and Accountability Act in organic standards. This legislation establishes a 5-year repeating process where USDA, its advisory board, and stakeholders work together to ensure evolving market data is included in modern organic practices. For farmers, land managers, and others not in the organic space, the ability to produce abundant food, feed, and fiber relies on access to safe and effective pesticides. However, some states have begun to regulate pesticides in a manner counter to the decades of scientific guidance from the EPA. The lack of certainty on EPA-approved science-based labels will erode access to current and future pesticides. It will threaten crops, grower incomes, conservation practices, public health, vital infrastructure, and ultimately raise food prices for families amidst record-high inflation. My friend, the distinguished representative from South Dakota, Mr. Johnson, introduced the Agricultural Label Uniformity Act to reaffirm federal pesticide label uniformity and prevent state and local governments from adopting inconsistent labeling or packaging that disrupts access to these vital tools. Growers and users need assurance that while states have authority to regulate pesticides within their jurisdiction, they cannot impose labeling or packaging requirements in addition or different from the scientific conclusions of EPA. In closing, Mr. Chairman, the pursuit of a healthy farm economy must be a top priority, and it is crucial to protect those that keep food on our shelves.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This chart, if you were a U.S. cotton grower, should concern you.
Kevin Brinkley is CEO of Plains Cotton Cooperative Association.
So this goes back to 1990, Brazil's cotton production. And if you look there in about the year 2000, they were producing less than 4 million bales annually. They were not a great concern to us at that time. Fast forward about 10 years, they're at 6 million bales. Go to the current year. Over 14.5 million bales of cotton produced in Brazil. They are doing this by breaking out large sections of acres, not just in prairie, but also in rainforest, whatever they can get their hands on. They intend to, you heard commentary about this morning, I totally agree with it, they intend to be the world's largest exporter of cotton because they, like the U.S., they use only a small portion of what they grow domestically. And so they are our biggest competitor today. And so if you have been trying to sell some cotton lately, we have not had a very easy time doing that because for about the past 6 months, Brazil and Australia as well have been able to undercut our prices. There's one problem with Brazil. I don't know when they'll fix it, but the choke point for them, or the bottleneck, I should say, is getting the cotton out of the interior where it's grown out, where it can get onto a ship and to the customer. So it's probably going to take them some time to fix that problem, but they're still going to be in our hip pocket. And they're looking at planting another big crop again this year. The weather conditions down there are probably going to lead to an increase in cotton as the first crop. They can actually grow two crops a year on the same acre in most cases. And this year, the trends certainly look like they're going to plant cotton first. So that'll be, again, another very competitive market for us. 100% of all the increase that you see on this chart is going into the export market. They are a direct competitor with the U.S., and so this should be a concern to us in our industry.
So the question becomes, why not bring some of that back home? Brinkley explains.
So we can make yarn in the U.S. actually pretty efficiently. The problem is you've got to get it to a market where it could be made into fabric. And even worse than that is the cut and sew operations are most always going to be chasing low-cost labor. So we saw this happen in China back during the late 90s and, say, up until about 2010. And they actually sort of priced their labor to a point where it wasn't the most competitive. You saw a lot of that business move into Southeast Asia. Vietnam would be a great example of that. Bangladesh, Pakistan, Turkey are all places where the labor costs attract textile production. You look at the Caribbean Basin countries, Central America, Mexico, again, some real labor advantages there. So I think this is just Kevin's opinion, but for us to reshore a lot of that industry here would take a lot of automation. So think robotics and things like that that don't, and we can't get people to work anywhere in this country, so it would be hard to get them at any rate that's competitive. There's a company actually here in the U.S. called Bella and Canvas that makes T-shirts. You've never heard of them because they rebrand them as other things. But they have actually started down this road. If you can find them on YouTube. They'll lay out 140 layers of fabric on a table the length of a football field, and a robot will go down there and cut the components of a T-shirt out. But you know what they have to do with them? They have to send them down to the Central America to have them sewn into a garment. Then they bring them back here and still sell them for $5. It's amazing.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
One thing we did was pulled out the farms that had 10 or more years of experience, since we had a lot of those farmers this year. And we found that those farmers in fields that had cover crops versus fields that didn't. Keep in mind, most farmers have some fields of both situations. That's a fairly common situation to have fields with both cover crops and none. That those that were able to provide that data, it was about a 6.3% yield gain on soybeans and a very similar number on corn for those with 10 years or more experience. So they've really become comfortable with using cover crops, know how to optimize their management.
Some of the details from the 2023 National Cover Crop Survey. Dr. Rob Myers with the University of Missouri.
On the flip side, the farmers that were pretty new to cover crops with 2 years or less of cover crop experience still had modest yield gains with soybeans. This is similar to what we've seen in past surveys, about just over 3%. And the corn yields were not statistically different. There were some fields with corn that had higher yields, some with lower yields. We know if you use corn after cereal rye and don't adjust your nitrogen management, occasionally people run into some yield losses. But overall, the corn yields were the same for those that were relatively new to cover cropping, but much better if you had several years of experience.
Moving from cover crops to soil testing, Shelby Varner reports.
Soil testing can take place many times during the year, but K-State soil fertility specialist says fall is an ideal time to sample because it allows producers time to remedy concerns. Dorvar Ruiz-Diaz discusses the different nutrients that can be tested for and how to sample fields.
And in terms of the key nutrients that we often tend to look at is phosphorus and potassium primarily. Those tend to be the most limiting factors. But something that we want to look at very closely as well is pH. And this is particularly important if we have legumes in the mix, which can be very sensitive to low pH situations. We need to make some corrective action for pH. We do need some time for that lime application to react and change that pH. And so, again, with fall sampling and in the case of needs for lime application, this will give us plenty of time before the spring. And so those are some of the key nutrients that is often good to evaluate. Of course, we can look at other nutrients as well, things like sulfur and nitrogen as well. But again, those tend to be less of a limiting factor. But again, once we have the samples, it's good to analyze for other nutrients as well. May not need to be analyzed more frequently, such as the case of P and K, but it's good to have information as well on other nutrients, things like organic matter, for example, and texture even in some cases where we're trying to have a better assessment of the characteristic of that particular field.
Diaz says sampling at the appropriate depth for different nutrients is important to get an accurate sample.
One thing that is very particular, of course, is that if we do lime application, in some cases, it's going to be only on the surface. We're basically not incorporating any of these. And so we really talk about a sampling depth typically of about 3 inches. So if we suspect that we have some pH issues, different sampling depth of 3 inches is recommended. Otherwise, for other nutrients, the recommended sampling depth is going to be 6 inches following the K-State recommendations.
He explains a tool that can be used for this process.
And so here's what we need to pay attention to: how we are collecting the sample, things like a number of cores that we are collecting. It is important that we collect many subsamples. Typically, we will recommend to use a soil core and try to collect at minimum 15 to 20 cores, which those are basically subsamples that are going to go into one sample that you will be submitting to the lab. And so this is very important to basically get a representative sample of that particular field.
That was K-State Soil Fertility Specialist Dorvar Ruiz-Diaz. This is Agriculture Today. I'm Shelby Varner.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
As farmers balance their financial books for 2023, analysts at the USDA say that on average, those producers' expense ledgers will show yet another increase this year in production expenses.
One of the things that you've seen here is obviously a lot of volatility in input prices.
But USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer says a lot of that volatility happened in the early months of 23. And for all of the year, USDA is projecting a 3.5% increase in overall farm production expenses. Two big contributors to that, a 43% hike in interest expenses and a 19% rise in expenses involved in purchasing livestock.
But we do have things moderating, like fuels and oils and fertilizer, things which had seen big run-ups in, say, the previous 18 months, showing some actual decline.
Meyer says farmers will have spent about 14% less for fertilizer this year, also less for pesticides, fuels, and livestock feed. Gary Crawford, Washington.